Thank you, Jim, and good to see so many folks here from friends and others. And for those of you who've come up and said hello to me and I haven't remembered your name, I'm going to be signing up for the Erasing Aging group right after this. But thank you all for being here. And I first want to say a really heartfelt appreciation to you here at Edmonton St. George's United for your commitment to this whole movement of restorative justice and compassionate justice. I like the word compassionate justice. And for actually for hosting this forum. You know, there's all kinds of forums that relate to criminal justice and bring professionals together and so on who can talk about this, but they usually cost a lot of money. This is one of the few public forums that's offered free of charge in which we can come together with our neighbors and to discuss really important issues about how to have a more just criminal justice system and a more compassionate system. So I just say what a wonderful thing you are doing for the whole of our community. And in particular to acknowledge those of you from this congregation who are putting yourself out there, who are walking the walk that, in the ways that at least I am aware of, and there may be others who are as well. But Jean Bruce, who helped initiate this, Walter Wells, Jim Black. Folks, you don't know the hours that Walter and Jim have put in walking with people one-to-one and in circles on the community. And they are amazing, as are Ann Barrett, of course, who's also been involved, and Versa. Ben and Rick. Now, Rick, where's Rick? He's here, isn't he? Is he here? There he is at the back. And Rick has become part of our Dismas Fellowship, and he also brings along his therapy dog. Now, we don't have it's not a therapy group, but we have a therapy dog who is actually deaf, and he's sort of the star of the show when he comes, wandering around trying to pick up food and receiving a lot of affection. So, I just want to acknowledge you as real heroes and people who are faithful to the gospel, as I understand it, to the whole vision of Christ in Matthew 25. I don't want to say a lot, but famous last words. The road home is not easy. I just came into this kind of home ministry after I left teaching, long time ago, 1973, I came as a two-year volunteer with Mennonite Central Committee to help get a program going called Man to Man, Woman to Woman. And here we are, still here. And through that time, I've walked with a number of folks and involved in a number of programs, including Circles of Support and now the Dismas Fellowship Network. And as I thought of today, I remembered this kid that I met, like way long time ago. He had just come out of Millbrook Correctional Center, which is up near Peterborough, for those of you who know it. It was a maximum security provincial prison. That's where they made all the license plates for a while for the province. And he has since closed down. But my friend Sid was just a young guy from the west end of Toronto. He'd finished a deuce less back-to-back. For those of you who know, at that time, you could have these 2 years less a day sentences back-to-back. So he just finished 4 years of the institute. I said, well, when you get out, let's get together and have breakfast. So I met him in the community after release. And we got together on Roncesvilles at a Greasy Spoon on Roncesvilles. And I walked in the door in the morning. And there he was sitting at the back of the restaurant with his back to the wall, the very back table. And of course, that's what happens with when you've been inside. You like to sit with your back to the wall. That's how one of the ways you can keep safe, right? And there he was, this skinny kid with long hair parted in the middle, right down to his shoulders. And I said, how are you doing, Sid? And I remember his words. He says, tell the truth, I kind of miss my cell. And then we ordered bacon and eggs and the menu and sat there He says he picked up the knife and fork. Those were the days when the only cutlery was a spoon in the provincial institutions. And he said, as he picked up his utensils, how do you eat with these things anyways? And sometimes it is the simplest things in conversation with my friends who I've known over the years that remind me how dislocating and how disempowering the whole prison experience is. Some of you will talk about that more eloquently than I can. But I talked with my friend Keith a couple of weeks ago, did a lot of time inside. He said, I didn't know how to open a door. I didn't know how to open a door correctly when I got out because, you know, how do you, you don't have door handles that you can use after spending so much time. Or I thought of, I think of the man who I never met, who was coming out on release last year from one of our camps and found out just before he got out, and he had served a lot of time, that he was going to have to go to a shelter because there was no other accommodation for him. He was coming out at the end of his sentence. And he took his life that day rather than come out and leave behind that which he's known. So many other folks. I think one of the effects of prison and coming back into our community, and someone told me, you know, you don't do your time until you hit the street. That's not to say that prison is easy, and folks will talk about that. But I think there's a reality about that, that in coming back to the community, there is you bring with you all that which is inside of you from the prison culture, from the routine, for the lack of decision-making that happens in there. You follow a routine, you follow the menus that are prescribed, everything is routine, and you come out, and now what do you do? Now what do you do? I had a conversation with a friend this week who said to me, Harry, how do I get prison out of my head? I wake up at night and I feel like, sometimes in a bad dream, that I'm back in my cell. And it takes a long time to go back to sleep. How do I get prison out of my head? So one of the things that we have developed, or tried to envision as we created this fellowship for ex-prisoners, which we call Dismas Fellowship. For those of you who are not Catholic and don't know the person of Saint Dismas, it's a story in the scriptures found in the Gospel of Luke, in which Jesus is crucified between these two bandits. They're probably terrorists. That's why they're crucified outside the wall. And the one says to Jesus, will you remember me when you come into your kingdom? And without any kind of preconditions or questioning, Jesus says to him, today you will be with me in paradise. And for us, we found in that interaction with our Lord kind of a theology of what we're doing, that we could become integrated and identified and create community as our Lord did, without any preconditions, without judgment, because there was none in that episode. So we called, the Catholics gave him the name Saint Dismas. You won't find it in the scriptures. But if you Google Dismas, you'll see all sorts of references in various ways around North America. So we created this Dismas Fellowship, which is not a therapy program. It really is a safe and welcoming place for people when they come out, where we can meet, where we who are part of a so-called normal society can meet those who are trying to find their way back again. And so we started 16 years ago, and now there are about a dozen of these fellowships around the province, and a new one starting in St. Catharines in March. And created this charitable organization called Friends of Dismas, seeing that there are three primary needs for people who come out. And we've borrowed from Diane Capone, who worked in the mental health fields. Many of you may have heard of her. That everyone coming out of prison needs a safe place to live. Something useful to do with their life. And friends. So we've concentrated on creating community where people can meet and create relationships. Because when we're going through the roughest of time, if we have no one there, that makes it even more difficult. I was reading about the prison system in Norway, which has about a 20% recidivism rate over 2 years, and is really treating people with respect, with treatment, forging new skills, etc. And one of the prison officers, they don't call them guards, they call them prison officers, said that there are no life sentences here. We are releasing our neighbors Think about that. What would that do in terms of a mindset for our correctional system if the staff, volunteers, us, could say we are releasing our neighbors from prison? Because it's the basic truth. We're going to be living together again. Folks have been put inside, but they're coming back to be our neighbors. So what kind of a neighborhood do we want? To ask sort of the Fred Rogers questions, won't you be my neighbor? To think of it in that way puts a whole new cast on it. Rather than being monsters and deviants and people that we need to exclude from our society, our prisons release our neighbors, our nephews and nieces, our sons and daughters. And how can that be done in a way that is safe and healthy for them and for our communities? Safe and healthy for the victims of the offenses that have happened. That is about shalom. How do we create that shalom community? So, I'm going to stop. I want to introduce three really wonderful friends who talk from their experience. You want to hear them more than me. And I just invite them to come up. And first is Nikki, who is here. Nikki, do you want me to use this thing? Okay. Nikki, we're just saying in the car on the way here that we've known one another now for almost 15 years. And Nikki lives in Brampton and so did a federal sentence in Grand Valley and has, with some struggles, is rebuilding her life and rebuilding her relationship with family. And so she's going to talk first. And then Chris, would you come up, Chris? Chris, I've just met this past year, and he's been part of our fellowship in Toronto. And Chris has done a lot of time inside, and he can talk to you about as much or as little of it as he wants. But Chris and his fiancée, Tiffany, are rebuilding a life together in the community. And Joseph, who is here, Joseph has just joined a new project that we have formed called Restorative Justice Housing. And he will be talking to you about that. Identifying that need for a safe place to live. And we have some wonderful news that I think that is maybe happening today, which he will say. This is a new project that is formed out of the need and hearing the cry of folks at our conferences. Where can we live after we get out of the halfway houses? Where can we find a place to live when I'm on Ontario Works or on ODSP? And the board chair for our housing is here, and I'll introduce him, is Jim Harbell. Where are you, Jim? He's way at the back, so you may want to talk to him afterwards. This is a new initiative that's happened. We formed a charitable organization, and Joseph will talk more. Nikki, go for it.
Good afternoon. To give you a little Coles Notes version of my story to save a little bit of time. I was in a very abusive relationship and found out about some serious infidelity issues in my relationship on the sort of around the time of my 29th birthday and into that night and the following morning, very early kind of sunrise. That day led to a terrible fight with my partner and led me to being knocked right out, flash a light, ringing in my ear, kind of a knockout, and then put into my vehicle to go to the bank and draw out all of the money. I was in a horrific car accident, and a lady that was just 2 minutes from her home in the back seat of the vehicle with her two sons was killed on the scene, and I was not immediately arrested. Was arrested about a week later after all of that news, and ended up doing some time in a federal institution for that. Before my time in the institution, my partner introduced me to crack cocaine. So for 2 years prior to being sentenced, that's how I spent my time, because I didn't know how to wake up and go to bed every day with somebody's life on my hands. And unfortunately, I knew that I could not take care of my two small babies, and so I had taken them to my sister-in-law, who then, because she had other children, she gave them to the ex's mother, my mother-in-law. So, sadly, they weren't with me, but at least I thought at the time that I had the wherewithal to put them in a place where they would be taken care of, so that I was, you know, I was in this sickness. I say now that it was sort of like an unintentional suicide. I don't know, because I felt like if I lived or if I didn't, I just didn't feel worthy because of this situation I had caused with this lady and her family. So I was sentenced, and I went to Grand Valley Institution. When I was there, my grandmother was very sick, and she wanted me to make the most of my time, so I really tried to do that. I got involved in all kinds of programs, teaching English and, you know, doing my own therapy and psychology courses, but also getting therapy for myself, working, going to church, and I did like 128 Bible studies, you know, just really centering myself in Christ. You know, I went out, I shared my testimony. I was really lucky. The warden let a handful of us go out to, Anne Graham Lotz was in town one time, and it was a Just Give Me Jesus conference at the Air Canada Centre. And being in a room with 50,000 people praising Jesus was something that had a real big effect on my life. And so on my release, I was released to Ellen House. Now, when I was inside, I, like I said, felt very unworthy. My children were kept in Ontario because it was supposed to be close geographical proximity to me. They were going to visit me. That all changed. Court orders were brought against me for no access. No phone calls, no letters, because the parents of my ex, she was saying that it would cause my children psychological damage and that I was a bad person and all of these things. So nothing was in my favor. Became very psychologically damaging to me. So I felt unworthy. I accepted no visits. I accepted no letters. I accepted no phone calls. Even when I was first at Ellen House, I didn't want any connections with anybody. I was released just before Christmas. My grandmother died Christmas morning. It was a very sad time for me. Ellen House made my first connection for me with Harry. I had an opportunity to go to court to try to gain some access to my children, and Harry sent... Eusebio was one of the first chaplains with a car to take me to court, and he connected me with Dorothy, who was like my first friend, to bring me to actually the Dismissed Fellowship, which I've been a part of now for about 14 years, almost 15 years. It's these types of fellowships and this type of a holistic approach to our lives that enable us to be strong and keep us grounded and keep us connected, to push us through. You know, one of my biggest prayers was always for God to give me people in my path to help me. You know, sometimes we don't make decisions that are great, or we don't feel strong, or we don't feel secure. There's a lot of people out there that are against you for who you are, where you came from, what your record says. This is the people that you need in your corner to sort of help you in your struggle, to sort of remind you who you really are. We don't forget where we came from, at least I don't. When you forget where you came from, you sort of give up. And not forgetting where I came from reminds me to continue to be the advocate and push for my friends and for other people. When I got out of Ellen House, I was 34 at that time. The first place that I had to, when I finally found a place to move to, That's the first time I lived alone in my life. No husband, no kids, no roommate. I was pretty near a relapse waiting to happen. It was a tough struggle. There's not a lot on your side. You know, it's easy to find maybe a warehouse job or something like that. I had education on my side. I went back to college to get, I got a diploma in community development and outreach. I graduated with honors. I had all of the life experience. I had the piece of paper behind glass to tell people that I was smart enough. I wanted those jobs. I wanted to get out into the field and work with people that I felt that I could help the most. I had the heart to do it. I had the passion to do it. I had the smarts to do it. But you know what? I have to tick that little box, and it's disqualifying me even 15 years later. It disqualifies me. In this past year and a half, one of my beautiful teenage daughters had got herself into some trouble, herself even, and if you can believe it, they still want to talk about and ask about, you know, when the police come or when the courts look up anything, they still ask about, what did I do? But what about me? Are you kidding? Even I have gone as far as to be included in doing volunteer help or doing things with DSMIS or doing things with Correctional Services Canada to get a clearance. And they'll still use that against me. So the struggle within the community is difficult. It's difficult to get housed. It's difficult to work. It's difficult to maintain anything without a connection, without a friendship, without a community. And that's really, when you add it all up, this whole thing, this whole community, and this, honestly, this turnout is really amazing. It's beautiful. Thank you.
If we, can you hear me? Does this come through? Is on? If we have time, you'll have to tell the ring story. If we have, I love that story. Chris, this is scary, isn't it? Be in front of all these people.
Okay.
You're okay? All right.
Hi. I guess the word incarceration is just a word because my prison really began in my family home. I was raised to feel like an outcast, to feel like a second-class citizen. I was raised for abuse. So when I was 14, I guess I started getting in trouble at school. I started to fight. When I first began employing violence as a solution to conflict, I felt a sense of gratitude from people. People respected me. At least that's what it seemed on the surface. And that sense of pride fueled my decision-making for a long time. So I was in group homes from the age of 14 to 18. I started to get in... I think I got my first adult conviction 12 days after my 18th birthday. I got in fights. I served a couple 6-month reformatory sentences. Then it was 16 months. And then I got 2 years for punching my neighbor. I got out. I began to use substances. I began to drink. And that was more of a coping mechanism to cover up shame, because I felt guilty for who I was. I felt guilty of the emotions I felt. I felt guilty of the way I acted. But that guilt continued to compound on further guilt and further poor decision making. So about 14 years ago, I began to hang out with some people that were troublemakers too, that I felt they didn't judge me. They accepted me for my past. But they were, they weren't honest in their feelings towards me, and we would drink, and one night they beat me up, and I guess that's what they do. They like to beat people up, and they think people aren't going to react to them beating people up. But I'm not that type of person. Or I wasn't that type of person. I didn't care if you were 10 people or 15 people. I would fight you. So they jumped me. There was a few of them. And when I woke up, I walked into the house where they were, and I grabbed a bat, and I settled the score. I beat one of them to death with a baseball bat. Another guy tried to take the bat off me, and I hit him with a bat. And then I was arrested, charged with first-degree murder. The human mind doesn't really want to feel wrong, so it will do anything it can to justify its actions, because it doesn't like the feelings of being wrong. And even after that charge, I tried to justify my behavior. And maybe that's what it seems like now. You know, I'm telling you about what they did to me and then what I did to them. But that's not the case. I'm just telling you what happened. But when I was in jail, I would justify my behavior. Well, these guys jumped me. I had a right to do what I did. So that would mask the guilt. That would mask the feelings of shame. And I didn't like God. I thought God was fake. I thought the Bible was full of contradictions and half-truths. When they first arrested me, they housed me in segregation, and they kept me in segregation for 2 years throughout my trial. And a chaplain came up and he used to talk to me about God. The first thing I said was, I don't really believe in God, and when I get to heaven, I will blah, blah, blah. I was quite rude about what I said of what I would do to God, and I mean, that's arrogance. But he didn't give up on me. He continued to come and talk to me about God. So they tried to integrate me into the general population, and so I was on a range for about a week, and I had started to believe in God. I started to read the Bible and try to understand it more. But I still held on to these old beliefs, these old scripts that it was okay to use violence against people if they were violent towards you. So even only being on the range for a week, one night a guy started with me and I beat him up. And he said when he recovered that I'm not going to let this go. And so that night, a buddy of mine on the range who I had done previous federal sentences with passed me a knife. In jail they call it shank or jigga or whatever, some slang names. So he passed me a knife under the door, and he says, "You're going to have to kill this guy in the morning." And like at that time, I was prepared, you know. I use words like Shakespeare, like once more into the breach, you know. And I tried to, you know, build my confidence up so I could go and kill this guy the next day. But at one point during the night, God broke me down. And God, I'm not going to come up here and say God and me were having a conversation, because that's not what it was. But I ended up seeing a guard come by, and I passed the knife to him. Now, I guess you guys have probably never been incarcerated, so you probably don't, oh, well, that's a good thing. But in jail, you live by a code. You live by, you don't talk to the guards. You take matters into your own hands. You don't be a rat. What I did in jail is considered no good. So the guard came and took me, put me in the hole again. But at least then I thought I could be a true Christian. You know, I didn't use violence. I stopped fighting after that. I went to trial. I thought I would get convicted of manslaughter because there was mitigating circumstances. His father, the victim's father, used to come to court every day of my trial. And God talks, I mean, if you've read the scriptures, you understand that the true sacrifice is a broken heart. And I seen him every day, and I owed him. I owed him more than I owed myself. And I pled guilty to second-degree murder, something I never thought I would ever do. I know what the prison system is about. And I didn't think that I would ever get out of jail. But I knew that I made it good with God because I took another man's life. But with God, nothing is impossible. With man, everything is impossible. We had a conservative government for a lot of years in my incarceration who had a stance tough on crime. They wanted to lock murderers up forever. But maybe a year and a half before I was actually released, the Liberal government got a majority across Canada. Now, I'm not a political person myself, but I know the Liberal government has different views on crime than the Conservative government. And everything just seemed to fall in place. So I got released 6 months after my day parole eligibility. I was able to go to a halfway house here in Toronto. I have 14 assault convictions. I've probably been in over 100 fist fights. I've used weapons to defeat people that I thought were my enemies. But you live by the sword, you die by the sword. And that person's dead now. So I got out. And like she said, it's really hard for people with our past to get jobs. I have an education. I've written a few books in jail. I've submitted a book for publication. It's a fictitious book. I wrote my autobiography, but I've made no effort to publish that yet. I got a job 18 days after I got released as a carpenter's helper. They saw some intelligence in me, I guess, and they put me into the office. But I was like, I think I might have been the worst carpenter's helper there is. So I've been employed with this company for a while. It's not as great as I would imagine. I kind of feel stuck. I don't think they pay me enough. I think in some, the taxes thing's a bit of an issue with them. But I'm doing the best I can. And I appreciate you guys giving me the chance to talk. Thank you.
Joseph.
Thank you for coming here today. Appreciate it. Can you hear me okay?
Is that okay?
Louder?
There you are.
Louder. Okay, excellent.
There you go, Joseph.
All right, thank you very much. great to see so many people here today. Let me tell my background is a little bit different than his. I am the first and these many years later still the only Canadian to receive a federal sentence of imprisonment for insider trading. I did time in two maximum security prisons, a medium prison, a minimum prison, four jails, and two halfway houses in my experience. going from someone who never even knew anyone who'd been to prison to go to the hardest prisons we had in Canada, I saw the abuses and the shortcomings. And then when I got out, I saw the abuses and shortcomings from society towards ex-prisoners. There is no other group in society where you can openly discriminate against them for housing. You can just say, you have a criminal record. They don't care how many years ago it was, what it was for, or how contrite you are, or how much you want to reintegrate in society. They just do not rent a home to you. And that lived experience, the difficulties I had finding a place to live, has led me to a group now, a charity called Restorative Justice Housing Ontario. And their mandate is to find homes for people that have prison records, but are committed to reform, reintegrating society, but for the fact of their record and perhaps financial means, or they have no more family connections because they've been away so long, they can't find a place to live. So it's our job. We find housing for them. We pay market rent to the landlord, and then we give a reduced rent to the residents who are ex-prisoners. And the benefit of that is it's a win-win for everybody. The landlord, of course, gets secure payment. The residents get to live in a place that they could not otherwise afford. And the society, and as you, all of us together, society benefits, because these are now three people in each home that are less likely to commit crimes again, less likely to make demands on the social services, and less likely to make the huge expensive demands on a criminal system if they have to be in prison again. Because I know when I was inside, I was told it cost about $200,000 a year to incarcerate me in a maximum security prison. So that's an incredible amount of money, as opposed to just giving a place to live and finding secure employment, and they're going to be less likely to commit offenses again in the future. So if you'd like to learn about our group, rjho.ca, you can check the website. I was going to talk a little bit more about it, but I feel almost inspired and almost obligated to tell one story from my prison experience. It's probably the only uplifting story I have, and I think you'll take something from it. It involves a little bit of a mystery that I've still not been able to solve, so I think this group might be perfectly situated to help me in that regard. A few years ago, I found myself in Kingston Penitentiary. At that time, it was Canada's oldest operating maximum security prison. It was in its last year of operation, and because of that, they weren't putting any money into maintenance. I remember it was February. It was freezing cold. I don't know if the heater was broken or just not being used. We had windows broken on the range, and a range is a collection of cells. So in this case, there was 15 cells on the bottom, 15 on top, and the windows were in front of us, and we had broken windows. I guess they were broken through the years. And snow was coming in, so guys would take their extra shirts and they'd stick the shirts in the holes so the snow wouldn't come in the range. We had a washer-dryer on the range. The washer was broken, so we'd wash our clothes in the sink with a bar of soap. And because it was so cold, we used the dryer. We pulled off the exhaust pipe for the dryer and let it run all day to keep the range warm. And still with that, we'd sleep with all our clothes on at night, your shoes, your pants, your coat. It was just that cold. I was there long enough that I was given the job of a cleaner. Now, a cleaner on a range is a person that, as you can think of, cleans the range, mops it, and hands out the food. And the reason I decided to do that was because it allowed me out of my cell for about 8 hours a day, which gave me access to the telephones, which would allow me to call my children as soon as they got home from school. Otherwise, I would never know when I would be released from my cell, because in Kingston Penn at that time, we were locked up for 23 hours and about 45 minutes a day, save for yard time, which didn't always come every day. So if I wanted to call my kids, I'd never know when I'd be released, or if I'd release at all that day to use the phones. So I'm handing out the food trays one day, and this is a really tough range. There's a lot of hard guys on it, and they know I don't really fit in. So they would mock me, they would belittle me a bit. But I decided when I went into prison, I would never let someone take advantage of me. So I pushed back. So one particular inmate by the name of Frankie, a young guy, big guy, tough guy, he started mocking me, but he must have referenced my children. I think he overheard me on the phone call or something. He said something disparaging about my children or my parenting. And I remember, I can't remember what I said to him. It was probably a very good insult, but I insulted him back in a way that maybe he wasn't accustomed to hearing. And there was a pause in the range. And then Frankie, loud enough for all 30 of us on the range to hear, said, "When my cell gets cracked open," and that means when my cell is open for shower time coming up, "when my cell gets cracked open, I'm going to come over and I'm going to F and kill you." Now, on the street out here, that might just be an idle threat, but inside, because of who he was and how he said it loud enough for everyone to hear, I knew he was obligated to at least try to kill me. So I went back to my cell, I turned off the light. My cell, again, was the only one that was unlocked. And I turned off the light, and I knew nothing good was going to come of it. Either, you know, best case scenario, I miraculously win this fight, in which case I will get extra time, which will delay my access to my children eventually. Or more likely, I'm going to be beaten severely, maimed, or possibly killed. This is almost a certainty. He's younger and bigger than me. So then I'm drawn by this inevitability of nothing good happening, and I start praying. I prayed so hard in the dark, and I said, Lord, if you could help me get through this to get back to my children, I promise I will try to take something good from the bad to help others. And as soon as I said that, I heard an explosion of metal. Boom! And then another explosion of metal. Boom! And then these feet were stomping, running towards my cell. And I got ready because I knew this, it had to be happening right now. And all of a sudden, I saw a hand reach and grab the cage door and swing it shut. And my door locked. And all of a sudden, a half dozen guards ran past me down the hall of the range. And once I caught my breath, I moved my head close to the bars and I pushed my face against the bars to look down the range, what I could see. And I saw two guards carrying a stretcher. And they were in my view and then they were out of view. And then a moment later they came in my view. And on the stretcher there was an inmate having a seizure, flapping around. It was Frankie. The inmate that was going to kill me was having an epileptic seizure. He was taken away out of the range. I never saw him again. And within a week after that, I had a parole suspension hearing, and I was only the second person, I was told by the chaplain, to have won that such a hearing in 5 years, and I had seen my children within a week after that. So within a week of that promise being made, at that moment in time, I'm saved from a fight, and I'm seeing my children a week later. Now, when I tell this story to people, some people say, oh, that's an incredible coincidence. Some people say, oh, that's the power of positive thinking. And others say, that's a divine intervention. When you needed it most, when you prayed the hardest, your prayers were answered. Now, however you want to take it, all I know is at that moment, when that happened, it was right after I had made a promise to take some good from the bad. And for helping me keep that promise today, and to RJHO, to help me keep that promise, I want to thank all of you. So thank you.
I would just say, if you can hear me, that the vision of RJHO is for people who have come to the end of the support systems, whether it's the halfway houses or whatever it is, that are run beautifully, but it's John Howard Society or Salvation Army or Elizabeth Fry. But once you hit warrant expiry, how do you find appropriate and healthy places to live when you're on and when you may not have job or family? And so the vision here is to provide a community of support. We want to start with one place, and we've raised some funding. Jim and the board have raised funding for this, that will put two or three people together in one place with some support from volunteers and others to assist them in this reintegration program. But it will be their place, will be tenants. We hope to have a number of these around the city, kind of based on a model out of Ottawa, which works with folks who've had mental health difficulties. And just today, we understand, you want to say something about that?
Yeah, I'm pleased to say that we found two landlords that are willing to rent to us. And the fact is, you might think that's significant. I can tell you it's very hard to find a landlord that will openly rent to people that have prison records, not let alone if you tell them there's going to be three people with prison records living there. So we found two of them. And it's very inspiring because our goal is to remove some of the stigma. If you look at your own lives, everyone's made some mistakes in their lives. Imagine every day being reminded of it, or if a Google search reminds someone else, a stranger, about it, and they use that fact, something you did 15, 10 years ago, 20 years ago, to discriminate against you on where to live. So our goal is now, with these two landlords, we're going to have our tenants in there, do the best job we can so that the stigma is reduced, and maybe they'll refer us to other landlords and it'll spread. And then in time, perhaps you mentioned the Norway model, I think Norway's actually, I've looked into it, and their success with having lower recidivism rates is largely because that society as a whole believes that once you've done your time, they're not going to hold it against you. They don't have a little checkbox on every job application or any rental application about whether you have a criminal record. And that's something we don't have in Canada. Because of my background, I deal with a lot of Americans. And Americans are, you wouldn't think, we think Canadians were more small-L liberal-minded or open-hearted than Americans. And I think in regard to ex-prisoners, I would tell you we're not. Americans are more open to giving second chances, to believe in rehabilitation. I think largely because they know more people in their society that have criminal records, whereas Canadians, it's relatively rare. So I think the default position for Canadians is just to shun or to keep away or to not take a chance. So I think with this project, with our Restorative Justice Housing Ontario, we want to, you know, say prisoners, they're just like you. They may perhaps made a mistake, maybe bigger than you, but certainly they paid their dues to society. They want to give back to society. And having a place to live is not too much to ask. And as a whole, society will benefit by letting them have a chance.
Well, like one Anglican priest said to me, he says, folks who are inside and the people in the church are both people with convictions.
So, going to stop there. Question time. Is it appropriate, Dan? Okay. Thank you very much for speaking from the heart so beautifully. Yeah. How